Okay, welcome to After the Collapse, and we are here with Dylan Powell and how we want, and Jim's here. You want to say hi, Jim?
Hello.
And hello, Dylan.
Hi, guys.
We thought, Dylan, we would let you introduce yourself and highlight the things about yourself that you are most proud of and that you find most relevant to our conversation.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. I was saying to you guys earlier, I never turned down campus community radio stuff because I used to work in campus community radio. I know how important it is, and I know the fight that went on to create the, station that you guys currently have up there that you're on. So that was a really cool struggle, and I'm glad to see that things are still happening. So thank you for having me on, and I want to honor that history right off the bat. As far as my organizing history or things that I'm proud of that relate to really the focus of this show, I grew up in rural southern Ontario in a small town called Dunville, Ontario. It felt like an isolated island growing up. I managed to bust out of there, break with a lot of the traditions as far as alcohol and drug use went. Went to university, didn't really get involved in any kind of social justice organizing until the end of that time period, but tried to put basically everything together. I grew up largely below the poverty line. My father was frequently involved in the legal system, either with criminal charges or civil cases. So from a pretty young age, I was radicalized through my own lived experiences. You didn't need to tell me at 11 that cops weren't my friends or that the justice system wasn't equitable. I'd lived that.
I'm sorry, I jumped in. I interrupted. But I was going to say, but you managed to. It seems, though, I might be jumping ahead in the story, but you put a positive spin on those experiences.
Yeah, when I did start to get involved in organizing, it just so happened there was a pretty multi-generational and supportive animal advocacy community here in Niagara. Part of my background had been in animal rescue previous to that. I never really put two and two together, but once I found a supportive community, I started to organize on the ground. That broadened out to environmental projects and advocacy and migrant justice advocacy, Haudenosaunee solidarity, because I did grow up on the Haldimand track and was well aware of all the issues stemming around the Haldimand track and the land reclamation at Gonestado. So all these things basically, you know, the lived experience provided me with a background really to have a politic that came from the left that was rooted in the working class and brought those kind of organizing skills that I had, you know, to the animal advocacy movement here locally and then with a bunch of different solidarity organizing. Being able to go through the legal system and see that and kind of feel a helplessness at a young age when you see your parents going through that, really drove me as an activist. It's part of the reason why I do a lot of coalition organizing is because I really, if something is really bothering me, I can't sit out. But then also really frames my advocacy in the sense of, you know, understanding that you know, people who profit, industries that make profit off of things which we find, offensive or, you know, the property or profit in and of itself, you know, you have to apply pressure. You have to actually identify those points and you have to apply pressure back to them. I learned that from a young age and carried that with me. And, I'm 28. I'm being, you know, dragged through the legal system now myself. So it's come full circle. But at least I bring that kind of experience with me, and I don't have the fear of the legal system that most people would have if they would have not gone through those things. So that's my kind of history of trying to take those things and turn them into something positive.
What's your first or maybe best experience of putting that point across and getting a positive reaction or outcome?
I don't, like, when I look back to a lot of the early organizing that I did, in the communities that I was involved in, Niagara specifically, geographically, you know, for folks listening in Toronto, they seem to think that Niagara is, like, across an ocean, or this, like, you know, faraway place. Again, I moved from a rural town to a region that is pretty isolated. There's not a ton of organizing going on the ground here. So when I did get involved, I really did have a hard time struggling to present politics that I felt could build a community, but that also had a focus on understanding things like capitalism. First things which, you know, were really positive, the lawsuit which I'm currently battling right now against the captive animal park here in Niagara Falls named Marineland Canada, it's pretty notorious, the park. Through that struggle, we brought in and made a focus 47 families that were evicted by the owner of that park. His name's John Holler. He basically bought up this trailer park that had been operating for decades, told the people inside the park that, you know, they were going to be fine. Their homes would stay there. He'd just be their new landlord. And a couple years later, he served eviction notices. Most of the people in the park, pretty marginalized. Folks who were on fixed incomes, folks who were on pensions. And they had invested into these trailers, which were fixed in their location, so they couldn't move off-site. Those people fought for 2 years to try and stay, and they eventually lost. And, like, horrifically at the end, one of the final residents, Paula Millard, actually took her life, refusing to leave her trailer. This was her last act of defiance, basically. So, trying to understand, you know, when the Marineland Animal Defense Campaign launched, was right around this time in 2011. And previous to that, you know, the idea, even in Ontario, as far as animal advocacy went, of opening up and broadening a message to bring in fundamentally another, you know, quote-unquote issue or changing messaging to not being just about, you know, how these certain people treat animals to changing it to, you know, what is the main motivation of that? Okay, well, profit. Well, how does profit drive, you know, how these multimillionaires not only see other animal species but people in our own community? And we made that link. And, you know, so far we've been pretty successful in organizing with the residents who fought that eviction, with their families, and using that not only as a tool to show solidarity for them, but to open up an understanding for people who are animal advocates to think about this issue not just in specific terms of one animal, one practice, one park, but in broader terms of, you know, what are the motivating factors which actually perpetuate these industries and, you know, why people actually get engaged in them and what kind of effect does that have on the broader community.
Well, one interesting thing about the last couple of years has been the attention focused on the Marineland case specifically, especially in the Toronto Star and their publications. There's been a, growing up in Niagara, you never heard anything about Marineland, animal abuse or abuse of, neighboring communities, but now suddenly it's taken off as a public concern. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it's like to have lived through that change, having started organizing there, but seen it, at least to some degree, get picked up by a wider community.
Yeah, so basically what ends up happening is, especially with the anti-captivity movement, you can see it happen in waves. There are specific waves, and they're almost tied to larger multimedia projects. So in the 90s, you know, it may sound cheesy, but there was an identifiable Free Willy wave. And, you know, that did get national press. Stories were run at the time. There were mass demonstrations in the mid-90s, and there were huge changes in that industry in the mid-90s. But as with most things that are driven by media cycles, they're not sustainable. And if people don't organize for a capacity that is sustainable, people end up reinventing the wheel. So there's another kind of wave which is happening currently right now, and you look at some projects like the Whale War TV show, the documentary The Cove, the documentary Shark Water, and then this recent documentary Blackfish are kind of driving these things. The reason why, you know, in the last you know, if you took a snapshot of 10 years, you know, Greenland got a good 6 years of almost no coverage. Part of that is because they were successful in a slap suit that they had filed in the mid-2000s against a group. They fought that for 2 years, but then after that, it basically destroyed their organizing capacity. So from about 2006 to 2009, there was no real organizing on the ground. And then in 2009 to about 2011, there's only symbolic protests, you know, a couple a year. So in 2011, we launched a dedicated campaign. Demonstrations go from about 2 a year to up to about 12, 13. We start to publicize things like heavy police presence on site, and the local press is completely uninterested. Marineland is a huge advertising, you know, like, just the influence that they wield, because they still have, they're one of the last remaining places that has this massive traditional ad budget because of that jingle. You have local press, you're just, you know, aside from the fact that connections to business elite and everything else, they just don't want to touch these issues. So when the Star comes in, specifically that's in relation to SeaWorld taking back an orca who was on breeder loan to Marineland named Akaika. That happened in 2011. There's a court battle around that, and at that time, a young Toronto Star reporter came out, Liam Casey, and it was kind of this, like, you know, convergence of just random things. You know, he was a young reporter. You know, he didn't really have the, I guess, the sense that, you know, maybe this isn't somewhere we shouldn't look. You know, I was a young organizer. I didn't have the sense that, hey, I'm going to get sued. You know, we were just doing what we thought was right. So he came down, ran some stories on Akaika, and did some background. And a lot of that background ended up being the later stories that were run after trainers came forward in mass the following year. Marineland had a press strategy forever of no response, no comment whatsoever. And when you deal with issues like animal advocacy, you're generally considered, you know, a fanatic, emotional, you know, all of these things. So generally most papers won't run a story on animal advocacy issues if you have a protester or a demonstrator and then the opposite side won't comment. With the Star investigative series, because they were able to get so many trainers to all come out all at once, it protected most of them legally, up to this point at least. And, it provided, you know, basically the focus to work out all of these issues, which had kind of sat in the background forever and not been touched by the local press. You know, if you look at issues that come out through those stories, like two local dogs, it's alleged that the park owner, John Holler, shot two of his neighbor's dogs because they broke onto his property. And local press knew about that story 2 years prior to that being published, but they wouldn't touch it. Because the Star had dedicated, you know, quite a bit of capacity specifically to the issue through trainers coming forward, that then gets out to national press. So,
well, I'm interested in, we're interested in hearing more about the, just the whole concept of a slap suit, and also, how the Toronto Star as a media organization ended up dealing with that with you. But before we do that, can we get your first song choice?
Yeah, sure. I think the first song choice was an Amoebix cover, Ted Leo covering Amoebix, Nobody's Driving. Post-apocalyptical, great song, I wanted to include that thinking about the show title. You know, when you think about what happens after the collapse, you know, that can either be a really positive thing or that can be a horrific thing where this planet's no longer inhabitable. So that song was chosen for the reason of hoping for the good choice, not the bad choice.
Fantastic. So here we go. Nobody's Driving.
In a sweat from the American dream.
Collapse, exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. You can hear us on RadioRegent.com and visit our website at afterthecollapse.net. I'm Louis Moroni. Jim Vernon, say hi.
Hello.
Jim didn't turn off his phone, and we're on Skype talking to Dylan Powell. So, Jim?
So a couple times in our conversation you've mentioned slap suits. And so, maybe in general, you can talk a little bit about the practice of slap suits, and then maybe one of the examples that you've talked about previously, give us a little bit deeper interpretation of that.
Mm-hmm. So slap suit, that's an acronym for strategic lawsuit against public participation. Basically, case law in Canada, you know, in most countries, is not updated to include grassroots or advocacy groups who have a moral or ethical concern against a practice which is either, you know, detrimental to the environment or a community. There's no distinction. People don't understand it. In Canadian case law, and especially in its application in Ontario with no anti-slap legislation, when you go before a judge, Marineland, say, brings forward an injunction like they did, he's basically presented with three different options of case law. One is, Ang Wei-Hongwei, indigenous struggles, which generally relate back to injunctions for blockades. Another relates to heavy case law from the 1980s that was used against anti-choice demonstrators trying to block women going into abortion clinics and accessing abortions. And then the other options, you have commercial interests who are basically attacking other commercial interests. So when you don't have a separate distinction for public advocacy, public concern, which deals specifically with a moral, ethical practice, and especially not in the case of, outside of a blockade setting, a judge is tasked with, in this example, you want to use Marineland and myself again, trying to either A, write new case law to protect public advocacy, or to try and kind of cut some compromise down the middle, because they know that one side has an immense amount of resources to file and carry out a suit, but also to attempt an appeal if they don't get exactly what they want. So you have this situation where, these corporations can use civil litigation basically as a weapon because there's a legislative void. A judge, could either swing both way, but at the end of the day, even if they write new case law, when you have such an unequal balance like that, a corporate entity can still continue to appeal and try to wear away at that. This is what we've been up against. The suits themselves, it's basically, you know, the punishment is the process. So if you look specific to the injunction, which Marineland was attempting to get, 10 of the 14 points which they had asked for, they were refused. And two of the motions which they brought forward, attempting contempt motions against myself for not naming names of other organizers, were both refused. So, you know, I can say this personally, I believe that they brought these issues forward not because they thought that they were going to win, but because they know that in the process of this, you know, generally if you're looking at injunction hearings, it's about $20,000 if you want to defend yourself. That's pretty costly. And that can go upwards from there, basically. On the other side, you have three corporate lawyers in the financial district in Toronto who are basically just tasked with, you know, how can you end this? In situations like that, if the legal system does not recognize two unequal partners, if they walk in and the law basically reads it as two equal parties just trying to hammer out a dispute, or, you know, seek resolution, they're not really understanding the interests or motivations of the corporations that are bringing it forward, or the interests and motivations of the, you know, advocates and people on the ground who are trying to bring out and expose issues of public concern which otherwise wouldn't be talked about. So the effect of the suits are pretty far-reaching. If you talk about, in this case, Marineland's filed 6 lawsuits from the span of December 2012 to June 2013. Two of those are against activists. Three of those are against ex-employees, and one is against the Toronto Star. This has an effect of scaring the crap out of people. You know, if you work in a government job, if you have a family, if you know you're scared about your mortgage, you know, all of these things, and you know that, hey, they're suing people right, left, and center, I don't have $20,000. You know, I'm going to basically back away. And it also has the effect in the press. If you look at this issue specifically, you know, if you look at when they filed against the Toronto Star and you look at coverage has really come down. And it's been much, much harder for us to get, especially mainstream news coverage, in response to that, because a lot of news departments, it's the same thing. You know, if you run an investigative series on Marineland, you're more willing to take the risk of, you know, if you know that a slap suit is coming, you're just fighting it anyways. It's worth it for your legal department. But if you're another news source, you know, either Globe and Mail or National Post, and you basically just have a one-off story and that's it, and you think that the other side is potentially going to trigger a lawsuit to try and get that pulled down, you know, you're just going to move on to something else. So
how much are the newspapers themselves then fighting this slap culture? Because I would imagine that rather than just wanting to jump from story to story, they don't want to be influenced by that potential lawsuit.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't have a definitive answer on the back end. If you look recently, we joined with Marineland Animal Defense, joined with Greenpeace, and about 140, and I think it's over 150 organizations now, calling on basically a fast-tracking of anti-slap legislation in Ontario. There's a bill that was put forward last year that looked like it was going to pass, and then Dalton McGuinty stepped down, and now it just recently has gone through second reading, and it's going to pass. Everyone is aware of this, but we're trying to basically push the government to prioritize this legislation to get it through. If you look at that initiative, that was a pretty big deal. You know, 150 organizations all coming together saying that this is necessary. A huge wide press release. No national news media source or, you know, large news media source picked up on that whatsoever. There was a letter to the editor submitted to the Huffington Post from the CCLA, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and there was some blogs and some smaller news coverage, but there was no national news media. Which to me was extremely odd. You would think that, you know, newspapers would have a stake in even just protecting sources. If you look at that investigative series, 4 people who have been quoted throughout that investigation have now been sued by Marineland. What does that say in the future if you're running, you know, further investigative series when you go and you say to someone, oh, no, you're legally protected, and, you know, they end up with massive legal bills. So I am pretty cynical about corporate news media. I think that they take the calculated risk of just moving basically from media cycle to media cycle and story to story. There's no, you know, it's not as if there's not other stories to break or other things to pick up on. If you look at, you know, news media in this market since, like, November, December, you can make Rob Ford a focus 7 days a week. There's endless angles there. And, you know, there's legal issues with what's happened with that coverage. So I would like it if corporate news media was more on board, but I feel like at this point also too, in their defense, maybe they feel that this legislation's coming, like most people, that this legislation's coming anyways, and that, you know, it doesn't need an extra push or promotion.
So here you are, you're up against large corporations who have the money and the gumption to sue you, to try to stop you saying what you're saying. You have news agencies who are either going to be afraid of that, or they might just think you're kind of crazy because you're an animal activist. You don't really have the majority of people in society jumping up to stand behind you. How do you keep on going, and how hopeful are you about the effectiveness of your actions?
Yeah, so it all depends basically on what your organizing model is and what your specific focus is. So for us, we organize on, it was a model that was basically created, or at least, you know, inspired by grassroots animal liberationists in the UK in the 90s, who built a mass through pressure campaigns that built from one campaign to the next, to the next, to the next. And those folks managed to shut down cat vivisection breeders, guinea pig farm breeders, and went on to start a campaign against Huntington Life Sciences, which is a huge third-party vivisection company that became an international campaign itself and had some really great wins, like getting them removed from the New York Stock Exchange, which is, you know, in most people's mind is something which is impossible to do. A lot of repression came down movement-wise in the mid-2000s, and those tactics were kind of forgotten about. So for us, the goal is to build through pressure campaigns, to build mass movements, to build capacity, basically, build the grassroots back up. And then through that, as, you know, whoever, wherever, and however the masses lead, that's where we go. On this specific issue, you know, you can talk about what is the majority perception. Support for captive animal parks is very passive. There's not a lot of people who you'll find out there who are diehard captive animal park fans. You'll find a lot of people whose kids hear the jingle and who badger them to go, and when they go there, they're not really all up on what's happening, or, you know, turn a blind eye. But there is a lot of people who are very passionate about closing these facilities. So it just becomes an issue of, you know, who is going to out-organize who. The other side has lots of profits, lots of lawyers, and lots of media access, but they don't have a lot of people who at the end of the day are going to come out and say, yeah, I fundamentally believe that keeping animals in wild animals in captivity for profit is a good idea. Generally, that's a small group of people, and that's, you know, the people who profit off these facilities. So for us, we look at capacity-wise, you know, in Southern Ontario, a couple of years ago, an animal advocacy demonstration that would bring out 200 people was considered, you know, that was the maximum capacity. That was a big win for the grassroots, and that's something that none of the, you know, the few national nonprofits that exist, you know, couldn't really touch that. Through the campaign that we've run, we've had demonstrations of 500, 300, 800, 1,000. That 1,000 mark stands as the second largest animal advocacy demonstration in Canadian history and the largest since 1984. There was an anti-vivisection demonstration in Toronto at Nathan Phillips Square in 1984, before I was even born. So, you know, for us, we gauge effectiveness in our ability to try and build mass movements and build the capacity for mass movements. And then also, you know, just looking at how we've raised kind of the roof for the capacity for organizing in this area along these issues. And then, you know, at the very end, our goal is basically looking at, you know, are we identifying profits? Are we, you know, having an effect on placing pressure on profits? And, you know, is that, you know, subject to our capacity and everything else that we're doing, you know, do we feel like we're doing a really good job? And when you're being sued for damages of $1.5 million, you know, it's my belief that a lot of those damages are self-inflicted on the part of the park because they refuse to deal with any of the substantive issues that come forward, and they make a lot of really wrong moves, very reactive moves, and kind of frivolously spend their money. But at the end of the day, they're responding to the pressure that we're applying. So there's tons of things, you know, when you organize on these issues, it's great to see an animal advocacy demonstration with 1,000 people in Canada, right? But as soon as that happens, it immediately sets into you like, okay, well, now we have to try and find to, you know, move this to the next level. And that's terribly hard.
Maybe we could talk a little bit just after the break about the challenges in organizing those people who are not yet committed to the cause and spreading it beyond the community which already exists, especially in a field where things are slightly passive. But maybe before we get there, if you can introduce the next song.
The second song, Tester Logic, Tables Turning. Darius and Chris have always been very supportive of this campaign. Darius actually performed on opening day 2000 of this year. They've done fundraisers for us. Love them both. Love both their politics. See them frequently. Blockades and rallies and all the fun places where, you know, it's great to be. So I wanted to give a shout out to them. You know, Toronto hip hop, radical hip hop, and people should support Tester Logic.
Well, here we go.
Tables turning.
The sky, these rulers are fly. Word to the wise, the world's occupied. It's time to break free. D&D colonized. Gotta realize we're gonna multiply. We want control of the kitchen, not the crumbs off the pie. Ex-workers hustle to get by. Unite worldwide, get free, let's ride. Tables gonna turn, systems gonna burn. Battle of the classes, put the ashes in the urn. Attacking slave methods, and we laughing as we learn how to take our freedom back and on our own terms. We're spreading like a germ, a free radical, a cancer to the system that's incompatible with love, liberty, and life on this planet. Talking revolution, do you understand it?
So that was Test Their Logic, and we're back with Dylan Powell talking about flat suits, marine land, and other activities. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about the challenges in bringing your movement to the next level. You've been talking about the successes you've had in moving up to a second largest administration in Canadian history, but now you want to move beyond that. I think you have an event you want to talk about quite soon coming up next week. If you could tell us a little bit about strategies for reaching out to those not normally committed to fudge activism?
Yeah, there's a couple different things at play. We've been really lucky with this issue in that when large media coverage came and when people, you know, kind of came in mass, we had had demonstrations that were large demonstrations previous to Toronto Star coverage, but, you know, when that issue did really explode, we were able to get out front with our messaging and really control the messaging for at least a year. So when the issue first exploded, a lot of nonprofits and people who were involved tried to really push a very welfare stance. You know, we have to increase better treatment for the animals on site. We have to create bigger cages, all these things. A bunch of things which just inherently did not represent animal captivity. You know, for-profit animal captivity is, you know, something which is, you know, morally offensive, which is how we felt. So for a good year, this is one of the biggest coups, you know, for us, is we were able to really stave off people, you know, cutting up this issue or dividing it along kind of welfare or rights or liberationist lines. And we're able to hold people to that message, to, you know, people who specifically just care about marine mammals or, you know, maybe don't apply any of these kind of ethics to other facets of their life or other animals. We were able to get them on board with this idea of, you know, for-profit animal captivity is inherently wrong, and we need to stop taking wild animals from the wild, from their families, putting them in tanks, and we need to take the ones that are there and get them to sanctuaries or sites of care. So for us, you know, that was a huge, huge battle. When things like this explode, you'll have a lot of different stakeholders who will all try to get their message basically on top. Now everyone, because we were able to successfully do this, everyone who's still involved in this issue is at least publicly saying the same message that we were saying a year ago. And that has helped, because no matter what now, you know, on the diverse kind of scale of people who are involved, people are at least, in our opinion, you know, pushing for substantive changes instead of just, you know, piecemeal reform and things which will allow industry to kind of sweep this under the rug. Second to that, you know, the way that we have organized since the very beginning is not typical to traditional animal advocacy campaigns, and that we have tried to apply critiques of intersectional theory to the actual campaign and open up a discussion about whiteness, you know, be critical of what whiteness is and how whiteness plays out in the animal advocacy movement. A lot of people don't realize parks like Marineland Captive Animal Parks have actual targeted newcomer advertising campaigns that are extremely aggressive. So you'll have a lot of people going into the park who, you know, maybe a newcomer to this country, don't speak the language, and they've got a bunch of, you know, angry white people screaming at them outside. That's not going to make a whole lot of sense. And we're not going to be able to change this issue if everyone on the other side of the fence, you know, speaks the same language, looks the same way, is the same age demographic. You know, or the tactics look exactly the same every single time. So we try to apply a diversity of tactics model, diversity of scale as well, and then allow that space for people to come in and critique, you know. When this issue did blow up in 2012, we had some large international nonprofits who wanted to get involved, who have been notorious at being extremely fatphobic around issues of animal captivity and talking about women as bloated whales and all this stuff. And, you know, we stuck our foot down. We didn't allow it. We didn't allow people access to the issue. People who are involved in this campaign have been involved also in removing sexual predators from the community, and have been involved in writing solidarity statements for things like Solidarity City in Toronto, migrant justice advocacy, and then also involved in Haudenosaunee Solidarity down here. So for us, so many of these movements are either balkanized or cyber balkanized, so they happen in kind of bubbles. For us to break out of that, we want to have a solid coalition politics so that we're not just reaching animal advocates. And we've been really lucky in the sense that a lot of folks that, you know, we've stuck our neck out for, when this issue got really hot, they stuck their neck out for us. And it allowed us access to whole new markets. You know, and when I say markets, I don't mean that we're going to make money off it, but whole new sections of the public, you know, that previously really would not have ever been touched by, you know, this message, because it would have came across in a very kind of prepackaged consumerist kind of reform, you know, message that's very white driven.
You know,
it's intentional on our part. And I think that for us, you know, moving forward, that's the thing that we always try to basically tighten up, is continue to make this a space where everyone who's organizing in a collective can bring these concerns forward, and we can understand, you know, difference of strength, and, you know, move forward outside of just this small demographic of people who care a lot about whales.
It's interesting that you, though your message and your intent and your ultimate goals are very different, you, in garnering the support that you need in order to do what you want to do, you're really playing politics. And I'm wondering, where you see your role in relation to politics, and whether or not you think politics is actually a viable route that to take to further achieve what you want to achieve.
Yeah. So, you know, right off the bat, just an understanding of building capacity, right? Of this idea that, you know, there's not just going to be some spontaneous action in the masses that are just going to you know, magically revolt. Throughout this issue, you know, you look at on the grassroots level over the last year, I know of at least three high-profile cases of state repression, or, you know, somewhat similar kind of slap suits, where there's been almost no capacity on the ground to provide support. And that would be Ron Plain in the Omgenon blockade, Mike Roy and Bailey Lamont in London, Ontario, for painting a brick. And for this campaign itself. So for us, we understand fundamentally that if we don't build the capacity, you know, if we don't have the legal contacts, if we don't have the support, if we don't have the support networks, if we don't have people coordinating their message and providing that kind of support, we basically might as well pack it in, because corporations like Marineland, if you go after parks like that that have, you know, multi-million dollar budgets to send over to lawyers, you're just going to get decimated. So for us, you know, playing the political game is playing the long game of building the capacity to be able to actually affect these industries and affect these structures and turn that profit back on them. For how this plays out with the actual, you know, political game, we've only had one political aim since the very beginning, and that is an end to wild capture. So in Canada, it's currently illegal to catch an orca off of either coast of this country and put them in a tank for the sake of profit. You cannot do that. However, you can import a wild-caught orca from Russia. What we're trying to push for is basically an end. If it's unethical, you know, if it destroys habitat, if it messes up the environment and these families of these animals in Canadian waters, it's no different in Russia. For us, if we can get that change implemented, you basically have grandfathered the industry out, because they cannot maintain themselves on captive breeding stocks. Anything else we see as a move to try and outflank public outrage and concern on this issue, and an attempt to really protect industry. There's been a lot of tough talk from Madeleine Meilleux, who's a community Safety and Correctional Services MPP who deals with prisons for humans and non-humans alike. And most of that, she's talked very tough. However, the moves that she's made have all been moves to try and protect industry. Marineland is a huge player in the Niagara Falls tourist economy, and you know, most politicians are not going to take a stance siding with animal advocates against a business like that. We're aware of that, and again, when it comes to, you know, playing the, I guess, politics game, as you could say, everything is basically playing the long game. We want to make sure that our asks are substantive and that there are things that we are actually following through on, so they're not, you know, we don't switch our political asks from month to month. It's the same political message over and over again. And we try to also be mindful of the fact that, you know, the political process and people who want to get involved will come and attempt to demobilize this issue through the political process, making it appear that substantive changes are going to come when they won't. So that's how we try to organize for the political game.
So you've made some really good points in the last few minutes here. I think your next song might actually be well-timed. Before you introduce it, I just want to note that you're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com, and you can learn more about us on After the we're talking to Dylan Powell on Skype, and our phones have been ringing on both ends of the line, our shtick tonight. And so go ahead, Dylan, introduce the song, and then I think we're going to want to talk a bit about your event coming up in the next week.
Yeah, so the last song, Eric Smith. Eric grew up in the same small town that I did. He was also one of the co-founders, you know, one of the people in the room when this first started back in 2011. Back in 2011, him and I were actually almost run over by the park owner, John Holler, an event which we will always remember. And this song specifically, he wrote after the last federal election, being super bummed out because everyone was all really stoked on the Orange Crush and everything else, and he decided that he, in response, as a political act, he was going to go down and busk at the local polling station, and I think someone threw him like 75 cents, and a bunch of people called him a bum, so he came home and he wrote this song. And I want to give a nod to Eric as, you know, someone who was involved in the beginning, and I also just really like the stuff that he did, and this isn't like, it's recorded, but you can't get it anywhere, so for people who really like folk punk, political folk punk, this is for you.
You're hearing it here. Eric Smith, they're all fucking assholes.
Sick. I was written around election time, I'm struggling with people's minds and the powerlessness that they find. But I swear their heads are comfy up their ass, not giving a damn that these fuckers don't care about class. The struggles we face every day, the people that we want to save, our parties just went fucking slaves. Sign, shouting all the clever rhymes, but just wanting to break inside to these politicians' homes, where I'll give them my vote with fucking flesh and bones. These douchebags are responsible for riot cops in Toronto, the bombing of Afghani homes. Don't think it gets much better than this, so instead of just raising your fist, pretend it don't exist. Why don't you just resist? So what mortality and fear. So what we do now, so lost, no way out. The terror that they insist force us, least resist them.
Okay, so welcome back. That was Eric Smith. You're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. You can find us on AfterTheCollapse.net. We're talking to Mr. Powell about marine and animal defense. And so, tell us about the Festival for the Animal.
So, the event that I had mentioned earlier in 1984 at Nathan Phillips Square was called Festival for the Animals. We wanted to give a nod to that because in discussions around, you know, where are we going next, you know, that seemed like a really big thing to honor. That event happened before the animal advocacy movement in North America really professionalized. And, you know, it was just huge and massive. And I look back to it and I think it's just amazing that it happened. The event is 4 days of, demonstrations, marches, a conference. It's basically, you know, the greatest thing for people who just, you know, they need more than just an afternoon of demonstrating. It's just, you know, that's just not enough for them anymore. It's going to kick off on the Friday night with a midnight kind of vigil and march on the park, Marineland Canada. Saturday is a conference at Brock University, which is basically trying to place the anti-captivity movement within the spectrum of social justice. So a bunch of the speakers are talking about you know, how it relates basically to this background that I've already been talking about for the last hour, you know, anti-colonial struggles, anti-racism, prison abolition, you know, women's liberation, anti-capitalist struggles, things like that. Sunday is the closing day for Marineland Canada for the 2013 season, so that's going to be a mass demonstration. Folks are actually going to start with a walk from a park called Safari Niagara, which is about 9 kilometers away, and then be met by the mass demonstration there. On the Sunday, we have, for folks out there who have a history of shredding the gnar, we've got Dogtown legend Peggy Oakey coming up to speak. She's a longtime surfer and ocean advocate, too. And we got a whole bunch of things. Darius is actually going to be coming down from Tesser Logic to perform. And we've got some more speakers. Jesse Reed, who's a local musician and ex-Greenpeace activist, is going to be talking about his uncle Paul, who's actually currently being held in Russian prison on piracy charges. So that day is going to be very big. And then we're topping off the next day with a demonstration at African Lion Safari just outside of Hamilton. It's Monday on the 14th is their closing day. It was important for us to, you know, give a nod to the history, incorporate, you know, some of our political vision. We want to really take the time to educate people at this point where exactly we think we are and where we want to go. And then also open it up to, you know, it's not just about this specific park. It's not just about specific animals. It's about the for-profit captive animal industry as a whole. And, so much more than that as well.
This is an incredibly ambitious project. so, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you decided to go this large at this time.
Yeah. If there's a one, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who are involved in the organizing collective for Marineland Animal Defense. And I think at this point, you know, people realize with all of the corporate repression that has come down and the way that that has kind of shifted kind of the internal politics and all these things, people realize that we have to try and escalate in some level. We've always tried to work on a, you know, really basic model, labor model of escalation. 4 days seemed like a pretty easy way to do that. It is overly ambitious. But most of the people who are involved, you know, we've been doing things overly ambitious for a while now across a bunch of different movements. And, you know, if we fail at being overly ambitious, you know, at least we tried. We'd rather have a political project that has a very broad vision, you know, as opposed to just having politics that are, you know, shallow enough that we can just stomach them and, and really hold our nose and get through them.
And so for those who, we'll talk in a minute about how people can join, but for those who can't make the event and want to support, what can they do?
There's a whole bunch of different things. You know, what I talked about is the political focus. If, you know, folks are into writing their MPs and MPPs, you know, anything helps on that issue locally. And then contacting Gail Shea, who's the Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries. And then Madeline Meyer, who I name-dropped earlier, who's the Community Safety and Correctional Services. If you can't come out to this specific demonstration, we hold, like, 30 events usually a year. So there most likely will be a demonstration at some point that you can make. So go to marinelandanimaldefense.com, find us on Facebook or Twitter, and, you know, follow up and support there. We also always, you know, encourage people to engage in their own communities. We support a bunch of different campaigns throughout Ontario through what's called the Grassroots Ontario Animal Liberation Network. So we help with organizing with folks with the Hamilton-Halton Animal Liberation Team, the Kitchener-Ontario Animal Liberation Alliance, Toronto Aquarium Resistance, which is folks who are running a campaign against Ripley's Aquarium, which is new there. So, you know, we want people to tune in. We want people to be involved and get active. But we also want people to not just, you know, forget about their communities and the animal use that's going on in their own backyard. You know, we want them to reach out and let's support each other and let's build a coordinated network and build that capacity that we need to actually affect change.
Hey, Dylan.
Yep.
You're 28 years old.
Yep.
You came from a small town. You had an interesting upbringing. You're in St. Catharines now, doing, or in Hamilton, I'm sorry, but you're doing a lot of activism, and we know it's a labor of love and it doesn't pay the bills. Where do you see yourself in 10, 20, 30 years?
I see myself in the grassroots. I still see myself tied into my own personal political focus. My politics draw upon a line of trying to understand animal and earth liberation through a coalition politic that brings in migrant justice advocacy and then also brings in Haudenosaunee solidarity. So that understands fundamentally animal use, but then also land theft and displacement of people through animal agriculture and things like that. I see myself working on those issues basically until I am dead. Aside from that, I do, you know, addictions counseling. Personally, I've been sober for 5 years. So, you know, again, before I got involved in advocacy, you know, I could have died at the age of 22. I had such a struggle with drugs and alcohol. And, you know, when you go through those kind of things at a young age and they really shape you, when you do get involved, you know, from the get-go, 5 years ago, even though I was just a, you know, punk kid from Dunville who didn't know anybody, I knew that, you know, changing my life and getting involved meant that this was a lifelong commitment. So for me, it's just about basically refining my politics and refining my approaches throughout and just trying to continually build upon the political analysis that I have and hope that it gets to a point where we can build some mass and build and hold some wins and continue on from there.
That's really fascinating and inspiring. So I hope that we hear from you again in the near and the future, the distant future. Mm-hmm. So we have 4 minutes left, and Jim, you had one final. We were gonna. Well, yeah, you said there was something in your question. There was one last thing about the event coming up that we wanted to know for people to be able.
Just more on information on how they can attend.
Okay, great. So I think we could just, unless you had anything else you wanted to say, Dylan, in the last 3 minutes now, just a final reminder of people how they can learn more about your event coming up and what they need to do to get there.
Yeah, there's a specific website that's a standalone website just for the event. So festivalfortheanimals.com will give you the full 4-day schedule. For folks from Toronto who are listening, we have a bus coming from Toronto to Hamilton to St. Catharines and then back up. So, you know, if you're looking to get out but you don't have a car, get on the site, sign up on the bus registration form. Other than that, you know, if people have questions about accessibility or anything like that, reach out, marinelandanimaldefense@gmail.com. We'll do the best that we can. We've always tried to be as accessible as possible. You know, we're built on a model of community building. We want people to be able to come out and express their concern and their outrage if they have those feelings, right? So other than that, social media sites, we're on everything. Instagram, I don't think we're on Pinterest yet, but you just wait. you know, at any time, you know, if people are looking for advice, people are looking to get involved, or if people are just looking out, wanting to reach out from whatever community they're a part of, you know, to see about how to work together and build coalitions and use this kind of politic to strengthen our analysis together, then, you know, reach out.
Well, thanks again, Dylan. I think your perspective and also the work that you're doing is very close to our heart and close to the mandate of the show. We'll put your links on our website as well, aftertheclaps.net. You've been listening to RadioRegent.com, and we've been talking, Jim and I. Say hi, Jim.
Hello.
We've been talking to Dylan Powell, so thanks again, and the best of luck on everything you're doing.
Thank you so much, guys, and we can talk after the collapse of Marineland. How's that sound?
Very good. Okay, great. Thanks so much, Dylan. That was fantastic. We really enjoyed that.